Okay, usually I wait for Steve to tell me when to go, but if he's not here, I'll just assume I can go. So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Reitzer Chiner spoke last week, and he'll be giving the third one next week as well. There are sign-in sheets around if you want the sources, the recording afterwards. Okay. So the topic I want to talk about today is one that's practical for many people in Toronto, considering how close we are to the U.S. border, and that's the question of the ethical and legal implications of expatriate taxation. Now that refers to a whole host of different issues, but I'm going to focus mostly on the question of individuals, in this case, usually U.S. citizens, who live in Canada, let's say in Toronto, paying taxes to the United States, and what is the responsibility and what are the implications for an accountant who is who's dealing with such a client? Now, at the moment, as we'll see in just a minute, most countries in the world have residence-based taxation laws, and you only pay taxes for the most part if you live in the country, with some mild exceptions, right? If you live in a country most of the time and you're traveling, you have a residence abroad, or you're doing business abroad, so you can be liable for taxes and some of that. But your primary residence usually has to be in the country to pay taxes, definitely individual taxes to that jurisdiction. The exceptions to that rule are primarily the United States and Eritrea. Which, okay, I don't know how many clients you have from Eritrea. Maybe you do, I don't know. But the exception that the United States has a worldwide tax requirement for any American citizen, any expatriate, whether or not you're a born citizen, meaning I am a born United States citizen, so I, for the rest of my life, will have to file and pay American taxes, but so will my children, who are American citizens, even though not all of them have been born in the United States. And therefore, every year I have to go through, I have to file my taxes, and either I end up paying taxes or the United States government ends up paying me for child stipends. I need to file an FBAR, which is the form that informs the United States government of all bank accounts I have anywhere in the world over $10,000 American, so whatever that is, Canadian these days. So that's the question I really want to explore: is what's the ethical halachic implications of expatriate taxation? So I put at the beginning a few sort of common cases to sort of frame our discussions. The first one is Jim is a born American citizen living in Toronto. And he does not make enough money to be obligated in taxes to the U.S., which is slightly more than $100,000 U.S. Varies by year, goes up. This year, I think last year was about $108,000 U.S. If you make less than that, realistically, you won't be charged taxes by the United States government. You'll still have to file. But he doesn't want to go through the effort of filing. Do you, as the accountant, have an obligation to encourage him to file? And so when I was discussing with Steve, the way he wanted to sort of frame the ethical question is an accountant's primary moral and legal obligations are to the jurisdiction they live in. Right? If you live in Ontario, so you have responsibilities to the Canadian government, to the provincial government, but the United States is not your government. Now your client comes in and tells you, look, I understand the risks, I understand what could happen to me. But at the end of the day, it's not like I'm stealing money from the U.S. I won't owe them money, right? Factually, I won't owe them money. I make $75,000 a year U.S. I'm not going to owe anything to them, and it's just a hassle, and it costs me X number of hundreds of dollars to file all the paperwork for U.S. taxes. I just don't want to do it. Do you have an ethical obligation or legal obligation to encourage him to fulfill, you know, to follow the American expatriate taxation laws and file? What about Jim's children who were born in Toronto, right? Does it depend ethically on the fact that, well, Jim at least was born in the United States, maybe he took advantage of the benefits as a U.S. citizen for years, but his children, like my children, right here, I could have just put myself, but whatever, right? Hold U.S. citizenship. Do you have to encourage them to file U.S. taxes? I know, like my brother-in-law in Israel, also American, but I at least grew up in the States. He did not grow up in the States, and a lot of people don't even realize you have to file, and it's very frustrating for them, right? It's one thing to say you are a U.S. citizen who was born there, so the U.S. says you owe taxes, you have to file. What if someone who just holds the passport but never took advantage of the system? Does it change? The next case I gave, Sarah's a U.S. citizen living in Toronto who would owe U.S. taxes if she filed. Must you encourage her to file and pay? Right? Sometimes people don't want to file, not because it's annoying, but because they know they're going to end up owing money. And what happens if somebody usually files taxes? Right, that's the third case I gave you. Most years, Matt, a U.S. citizen living in Toronto, files U.S. taxes and receives child benefits from the U.S. government as he does not make enough to owe his U.S. taxes. So basically what happens is if you file as an American, so you get a tax deduction, $1,000 per child. And if you don't end up hitting the threshold where you owe U.S. taxes, so they give you back that money in cash, right? So you get $1,000 per child. So what if every year he makes $80,000, $90,000? So he gets a bonus. He has three kids. He makes an extra $3,000 a year that the U.S. government sends him. And then one year he gets a $50,000 bonus, and he's above the number. So this year he doesn't want to file taxes. Does that change the equation, even if not legally, ethically? Because he's taken advantage of the tax system the last few years, and then one year he knows it's going to be to his disadvantage. He doesn't want to file. Yeah?
Curious. The $100,000 cutoff, is that after you pay your Canadian taxes, and is that your net income or gross income?
So if you make less than $5,000 or $8,000 gross, right? So you're not going to owe any U.S. taxes unless it's a little bit more complicated than that. U.S. taxes, if there's a distinction in this regard between a salary you get as an employee and salary you get as not as an employee, right? As an independent contractor. If you are an employee and you make less than that number, you will owe nothing, regardless of pretty much anything else. Basically, the U.S. takes into account the taxes you pay in other countries and you get a credit. So if you make under the $100,000 or so and you live in a country that has higher tax rates, then you will not, right? What will come out is you won't pay anything, except if you're an independent contractor, it's a bit complicated because then the tax system is different. Then it doesn't get the same deductions and you do actually owe money and it falls in a different line. Basically, under $100,000 gross, you as an employee, you won't pay anything. Once you get higher than that, you get a credit for Canadian taxes, but you will probably end up owing something. Not necessarily, depending on all your other write-offs, but that's when you're even in that territory. The exact details are a bit complicated. Okay, so to set out just the laws, right? First, just to establish what we're talking about. So as I mentioned, this is just to make it simple from Times Magazine. U.S. tax myths. Right? Why is this even a question? Why will an accountant in Toronto end up getting U.S. citizens who have to deal with this question? So, myth number one. If you don't live in the U.S., I don't live in the U.S., so I don't have to file U.S. taxes. That is false. Contrary to popular belief amongst expats, the obligation to file U.S. taxes does not end when you take up residence in a new country. The United States is one of only two countries, the other being Eritrea, that taxes its citizens no matter whether they reside. I assume that should be where they reside. Myth two, I don't owe U.S. taxes, don't have to file a U.S. tax return. In order to prevent the double taxation of income followed by U.S. citizens living abroad, i.e. tax imposed by the U.S. and the country of residence, the U.S. tax code contains provisions that can reduce or eliminate an expat's obligation to U.S. taxes. For instance, the foreign earned income exclusion allows expats to exclude a certain amount of income earned above $100,800 for 2015. Expats are also generally allowed to use foreign taxes paid as a credit against their U.S. tax obligation. Right, so you might not end up paying it, but I cut off the bottom line, which is you still have to file. Right, so that's really why this is a question. U.S. citizens, while a lot of the money they will get this foreign tax credit and will pay nothing, Right? They have to file no matter what to prove to the U.S. government whether they do or do not owe. And if they owe above that $100,000, right, this was 2015, it goes up a few thousand a year, but whatever it is, whatever it's going to be this year, you will have to pay. Now, what is your obligation? How does the Canadian government look at it? Right. So as I mentioned, most countries don't have citizen-based taxation laws. They have residence-based. So Canada, for example, will, for the most part, not tax its expatriates. But what does Canada have to say about a U.S. citizen living here? So this is a bit of a change. It used to be, as I gathered from a tax lawyer that I checked with, that the U.S. would not, even if it has treaties and extradition treaties with the United States, would not enforce extradition treaties with regards to tax evasion in a foreign country. And therefore, from Canada's perspective, it didn't really matter. But that's no longer true. And now, as you see in number two, this is a case from this year, right? British Columbia Supreme Court, United States of America versus Smith. Canada established that they will indeed enforce the United States' tax laws in Canada. And therefore, if you have a client who is a U.S. citizen and they don't pay taxes, it's not just that if they return to the United States, they might be prosecuted. From Canada, they may in fact be extradited. Realistically, if your client makes $110,000right over the minimum amount, the Canadian or U.S. government probably don't care enough because it costs too much money to extradite. But in theory, Canada will in fact extradite. For it, the case I gave you in two, just to look at it quickly, United States versus Young, Mr. Justin Rosenberg wrote for the Ontario Court of Appeals in paragraph 5, the combined effect of sections 15 and 19 is to implement the double criminality requirement. The authority to proceed sets out the Canadian offense that is equivalent to the offense allegedly committed in the extradition partner state. The extradition judge is therefore not concerned with foreign law. He or she merely determines whether there is evidence of conduct that would amount to the Canadian offense described in the authority to proceed. So in less legal jargon, Canada will only enforce its extradition laws if the law that is violated is a law that is recognized in Canadian law as well. So since tax evasion or tax fraud is a Canadian crime, they will enforce tax evasion of another country since that is a crime recognized in Canada. So even though U.S. tax laws is not a Canadian law, since the U.S. and Canada have extradition treaties, they can enforce this. And then in this particular case, the reason that Canada did in fact rule to extradite the person under a question, this Mr. Smith, was, as you look at the end, was because he didn't report $18.4 million of income, which came to a tax due to the United States of $8,256,897, which is why the United States cared at all. So again, while realistically they won't do this to your client if he or she makes just a few dollars above that mark, they in theory can, which means that Canadian law will de facto respect the American tax laws for U.S. citizens living here. Yeah?
I'm just wondering now with computers, if an American who lives in Canada is going through a SIMCA in the States and he never filed his taxes, when he crosses the border, could he be arrested technically?
Yes. Yes, not just technically. Not just technically.
He's in the computer.
Correct. I'm saying I know of someone in Israel, he didn't realize he had to file taxes. Again, not somebody who made the money, just someone who didn't realize he had to file taxes. He wanted to buy something in the United States, filed for a loan. That caused them to look at his account, right? To look at his history, and they realized he hadn't filed his taxes. The U.S. froze his assets, right? The U.S. does enforce this, and yes, they can arrest them when they enter the United States. They can freeze their assets. All the normal rules will, in fact, apply. One more, two more points, just to set the background for it. One is, in addition to the legal requirement, there's another complicating factor, and that's called FACTA. FACTA is the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, passed in 2010, which is a federal law requiring all non-U.S. financial institutions to search their records for customers who they believe are U.S. citizens, and to directly file the United States for force their the people to file directly with the United States so that the United States can look at their foreign accounts and determine whether they're making money that they are hiding from the U.S. government. So, for example, when I opened a bank account in Israel as a U.S. citizen, they asked me, are you a U.S. citizen? When I said yes, they pulled out a form that I had to fill out that gave them the permission to disclose certain basic information about my account to the United States. If a bank does not comply with FACTA, they can be penalized, having to pay up to, I believe it was 30% on a 30% penalty on every transaction they carry out in the United States. So therefore, banks around the world, even if the Canadian government, let's say, is not going to enforce the U.S. tax laws, the banks, because they're being bullied by the United States government, will de facto enforce some level of compliance with U.S. tax law. And the last thing I gave you is the FBAR, right? That in addition to paying your taxes and the banks being required to disclose it, a U.S. citizen is required to, as I mentioned before, declare all foreign bank accounts that he or she may hold. And this is something the U.S. takes very seriously. If one does not file an FBAR, so as of 2016, the penalty was, if it's non-intentional, not more than $12,459 per violation. And for a willful violation of not filing the FBAR, the inflation-adjusted penalty may be the greater of $124,588 or 50% of the balance in the account at the time of the violation for each violation. Right, so this is something that the United States government takes very seriously. So with all that background, so what do you do? If you are an accountant now, you are not a U.S. citizen, you don't have direct responsibility to the U.S. Government, but your client does. So what is your ethical and ethical legal requirements for your client at that point? So before we move to the halachic discussion, any questions on the theoretical, right, the practical background here? Okay. I will just note, as Chaim just showed this to me before, this may all be moot because as just this morning there was an article that one a possible change in the tax code in the new tax bill being passed by Congress may eliminate this clause in the U.S. tax code, in which case all of this will be moot and it will only be if you have Eritrean clients that this will be relevant, but at the moment it is still relevant. So, what? Apparently, that's what they're thinking about it. Only they're thinking about moving towards residence.
Oh, wow!
I literally read this at 12:31. Chaim was like, "I will stall for you, so you have time to read the article." But what I gather is that it's not imminent. They are working on it more imminently for corporations, individual taxpayers. It's in the works theoretically, but we'll see if it actually happens. That would be huge if that happened, but at the moment, this is not the case. So here's the problem. This is, besides the fact that I pay and I file U.S. taxes every year in no matter what country I live in, and I'm used to this, and therefore it interests me, the question from a halachic perspective, and I think it's an interesting question morally as well, and this is, in fact, one of the moral concerns that's been raised about the United States tax code in general, is why should a U.S. citizen living abroad be obligated to pay taxes to his country of birth or country of citizenship?
That's the privilege you pay.
So yes, I understand the logic. So let's sort of flesh it out here, right? So I'll start with the halachic perspective, but we're going to mix the ethical and the halachic perspectives together. In general, halacha requires, Jewish law requires that a Jew follow the laws of his home country. The reason is because of a rule called Dina Demalchut Dina. The laws of the country are recognized halachically as the law. Expatriate taxation raises an interesting question, which is, well, America really isn't my residence anymore. I'm a citizen, but I live in Canada. I live in France. I live in Israel. Does halacha think that the U.S. still has the right to Well, order me around, right? To give me commands, to tell me all the money. The question? What? Yeah.
Who said something about what the Dean is a residence requirement?
Ah, so that raises the question. Well, is Dean Al-Khuta a residence requirement or not? So here what I've given you is a basic survey of the different reasons that explain why Halakha recognizes Dean Al-Khuta. Meaning, why does Torah law, why does Jewish law tell you that you're obligated to keep local laws? So the source for all of this is number 5. That the Talmud says that important, right? One may not make change using money from the tax collector's box. The Gemara gets into a discussion of this, but let's just look at the English. But didn't Shmuel say that the law of the kingdom is the law of Din Malchut Adina, Sarv Chanina Bar Kahana, Said Shmuel, specifying the Mishnah speaks about a tax collector who does not have a fixed amount. In the Yeshiva of Yanai, they said, the Mishnah speaks of a self-appointed tax collector. So the Talmud says, look, you have to pay taxes if the tax collector is a real tax collector, if he's not really collecting for the government, he's, right, this is a corrupt official, so then you wouldn't have to. But the general rule is that halakha requires a Jew living in a foreign society, meaning not a Jewish society, to respect the laws of the country. Now, why is that true? So, theory number one is the divine rule of the divine right of kings. If you look in number 6, the verse in Nehemiah in the 9th chapter says as follows. I'll read in English. On account of our sins, it yields its abundant cries to the king, whom you have set over us. They rule over our bodies and our beasts as they please, and we are in great distress. So Nehemiah, when discussing the kings, mentioned this fact that God has placed the kings over them, and that's why they take our bodies, our beasts, they have control over us. And based on this, some of the earliest material we have from the Geonim, from the sort of before the year 1000, let's say the year 800 to the year 1000 or so, you find as follows, that when God gave power to the kings, this is number 7, when God gave power to the kings in the world, he gave them control of people's money to control them as they will, even those of the Jews, as it says, over our bodies and our beasts as they please. So the Geonim said, the reason that you have to respect the law is because God gave the power to each government to be in charge. And if God gave them the right to rule, then you have to respect their rules. That's why the Jewish law tells you have to listen to their laws. Now,
there's no residency attached to that.
One second. Rabbi Avram Cook, just notes that this power isn't just necessarily in a monarch per se. Right, Cook, and this is a topic for another time, suggested that when there is no monarch, so the power goes back to the people, and if the people then choose a different government, let's say a democracy or a representative democracy, so then the government has the power of a monarch from a legal perspective, halachically, and therefore the same thing would apply. Now, just from that, so would you say that that only applies if there's residence or not? I'm not sure, right? On the one hand, you could say no. So, no, right? You could say no, right? But on the other hand, you could say, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, because you could say, well, divine right of kings, so therefore they have the right to pass rules. But let's be careful. They have divine right to rule, and therefore they de facto control you, and therefore they have the right to make demands of you. Does a foreign government de facto control its citizens outside of the country? Let's assume they don't step foot in the country.
You need that consular help.
Well, let's say you don't, right? Yeah, but you don't. So you don't have to go to the consulate. But here's the question. So, and this is something to keep in mind. The answer might be yes for two reasons, even without going to the consulate. One is extradition treaties, and two is facta, right? Right. The fact is that since, as we saw, Canada will enforce U.S. tax law, that means they still control you. They still control U.S. citizens, potentially outside the country. And two is facta. The banks are going to force you to do it, which shows you that, possibly shows you, that the U.S. government still has control over your life, even outside the country. I mean, facta, I didn't give you all the details, but facta is actually a bit crazy. Everyone criticizes facta, because facta brings in the fact that banks have to report their U.S. citizens so that they can help the U.S. government find out who's hiding income brings in about $100 million a year or so to the United States, which is, you know, not so much money for the United States. But I think in 2015, compliance with FATCA cost banks around the world $8 billion or something like that to enforce, right? So the return, I mean, the U.S. government doesn't care, right? Everyone else is doing it. But, right, but the fact that it's that to the disadvantage of the banks, and still they do it, shows that maybe, yeah, the U.S. government actually has a certain level of control over its citizens, that it can twist the arms of the banks around the world. We had a question over there. No? No. Okay. Okay. If you look at number 8, Rabbi Yonav Garandi connects this to another law. There's a rule in halacha called Hefker Beit Din Hefker, which means that a court or a government has the ability to make things ownerless, meaning to control people's finances. And he argues, well, basically the reason that the government has to be respected is because they have control over your money. If they have control over your money, so then you need to respect their laws. One of my friends suggested, well, if that's what this means, so as we just suggested, if the reason that in halakha, in Jewish law, you have to respect the government is because they control you and you control your finances, FATCA, and the fact that they can freeze your assets, prove that the U.S. government, even while you're living in Canada or Israel or take your pick, has control over you. And therefore, in Model 1, we could suggest that, yes, Dina de Malchuta should apply even when someone isn't living in the country, and therefore the person in front of you, the U.S. citizen living in Toronto, should be bound by American law from a halachic perspective and from an ethical perspective, and therefore, even if you could get away with it, you should encourage them as much as you can, obviously, to follow the U.S. laws, pay their taxes, file the F-bars, their tax returns, and the like.
So how are you going to then apply quotation here from Bonabastra, critical to, let's say, a democracy where you don't have a king. So that was what I mentioned in nine.
Was that Rabbi Cook says that doesn't that kingdom is not necessarily democracies can take on the legal power of kingdoms.
Okay, so it's not necessarily
correct. Correct. Yes.
So theoretically, if you live in several countries based on halacha, you would have to pay tax to each one.
If they demanded it, right? Demanded realistically, at this point, it's only
all your income would go to paying taxes.
Theoretically, meaning realistically, this doesn't happen because unless you're a citizen of the U.S. in Eritrea, right? This is not true for most people because most countries only have residence tax. Plus, in the case of the U.S., as we saw, there's an exception, right? The first hundred and whatever thousand dollars, you get a write-off anyways for your Canadian taxes. But in theory,
well, Alaska doesn't consider all that. It just says you.
Correct. I'm just saying realistically. But you think about it, historically, yeah, taxes were. Right, backbreaking. This is just true. Now, Model 2 is a bit more complicated. Look at number 10.
One thing I don't understand, though, is the point I just put before, which is you are getting something in exchange for your U.S. citizenship.
So hold that thought. I'm going to come back. Don't worry. I'm going to get there. So, number 2. Rav Shimon ben Aderet, the Rashba, says, why does Jewish law recognize secular law? So he says, Mishum Damatzi Amalu im lotas mitzvotai gareshet chem sha'aret shalohi. The Rashba says the reason that you respect the secular law is because you live in their land and they have the right to kick you off. And if you want to stay, so you have to live by the rules. Right? You know, a parent can theoretically do this, right? They won't usually do this to little kids, right? But, they have a 25-year-old son still living at home and they say, you know what? You want to have parties every night, right? Then don't live here, right? You're under my house. It's under my roof. It's my rules. So the Rashba says, well, that's Dina Malchuta Dina. You live in my house. You obey my rules. Otherwise, get out. According to that model, Dina Malchuta Dina, should that apply to expatriates? Probably not. You got out. You are gone, right? You don't live there. You're not under, right? You're not living in their land. Model 3. Jewish law, in addition to having 613 commandments for Jews, obligates all people to keep certain laws, seven Noahide laws, but one of those laws is what's called dinim. One of the Torah's obligations for any person in the world is to set up a legal system. Rashi says that the reason Dina Malchuta Dina is binding, the reason that Jews have to listen and respect the laws of the governments and the countries they live in is because a very simple argument. If God tells everybody in the world, you have to set up legal systems, then obviously you have to respect those legal systems because they're doing what God said. Right? By setting up a legal system, they are doing what God said. And if you don't respect that, you're not respecting God's requirement to them. And therefore he said the reason Dina Malchuta Dina is true is simply because, well, if God wants them to have laws, and they have laws, then you had better respect them. Now, does that apply to expatriate taxation, to expatriate laws? Maybe, maybe not. Because until recently, and even at this point in time, most countries in the world do not recognize this as a legitimate right of a government to tax their citizens who are no longer residents. Right? This is the exception to the rule, meaning a legal system can function perfectly fine. In fact, all systems do except for the United States and Eritrea, without obligating citizens who are no longer residents in taxes. So is this the type of law that God wants or encourages or endorses? Not totally clear. In fact, many people think this is unjust, which is something I can't get into. But one of the possible exceptions in Malchuta is laws that everyone understands are unjust. The Torah doesn't necessarily obligate you to follow those. Since majority of countries in the world think that expatriate taxation laws are unjust, right? We'd have to wonder whether morally you'd be responsible, halachically you'd be responsible for expatriate taxation. However, certain thinkers thought that for sure it would apply. So, for example, Isaac Breuer said no. Who said, right? Who said that God only wanted domestic law? He's like, no, God wants law. In fact, laws that apply across borders, if anything, make the world an even more civilized place, right? Sort of localized laws, right? So sure, they keep order within your country, but they don't produce a unified civilization across the world. But if the point of Dina Malchuta is to create a certain level of order, international order, so international law, recognition of law across borders is actually better and more powerful than domestic law because it ensures that people feel bound by law wherever they are and that laws don't necessarily change and that countries are working together. And therefore, Breuer, mostly in the context of war, said, no, Dina Malchuta definitely applies over cross borders because God wants there to be order in the world. What better way than having laws that are agreed upon not just by one country, but they're agreed to be enforced by the international community. Now, the fourth model of Dina Malchuta, or not really Dina Malchuta, is maybe the reason you have to listen to laws of a country is because you agreed to. Right? You agreed to. There are many areas in halacha. I gave you one example in 13. That Rashaim b'nai Yer lahatnot al midot dehen val sharim val schar po'alim l'asyakitadam. Townspeople can make rules for measures, prices, wages, and fine those who violate the norms. There's this notion, a basic human notion. We are allowed to make agreements that bind each other. We call this social contract, right? Or we call it labor rate union laws, or we call it whatever. But this is, on a legal level, we call this social contract, right? On a political theory level. But basically, we all understand that we can require ourselves to follow laws by entering into agreements. So Rav Herschel Schechter has argued that nowadays, the reason that a citizen of a democratic country has to listen to the laws of the country isn't just because of Dina Malchuta, but it's because, especially in a democratic society where you vote, you're part of the decision-making process. You, at some small level, are involved in deciding who gets what resources. But by voting, by being a citizen, by partaking of that system, by being part of the system that determines where funds are allocated, you've essentially entered into an agreement with all your fellow citizens. So of course you have to pay taxes. You have to listen to the laws. You've agreed to be part of this great partnership, which is a democratic society, and therefore you have to listen to their laws. You've bought into the system, so now deal with it. Ritzvi Hirschayas, I gave it to you in 15, I'll just say it outside, suggested that this is really what Dina Machuda was always about. That the reason Halacha requires you to listen to the laws of your country was because by living in a country, you agreed to live by their laws. That's always why you have to follow the laws. Now, if this is why you keep the law of the land, so expatriates, right? Are you required? So I posted this on Facebook. I crowdsourced amongst my friends. And one person jumped in and said, well, of course, according to this, a U.S. citizen keeps his citizenship, has the right to vote, uses the passport, has consular rights. Until you denounce your, right, until you give up your citizenship, you have bought into the system, and therefore, you are obligated. I didn't want to put words in Reshechter's mouth, and, you know, mostly, until now, everybody else that I've quoted is dead. So I couldn't ask them. Reshechter is, thank God, alive and well, so I figured I can't put words in his mouth. So I emailed his son, who then asked his father, and Rav Shechter said he's actually not sure. He's not convinced that the fact that you could vote and that you used your passport and you could, you know, go to the consulate for protection is enough to prove that you have agreed to be part of the, I don't know, American project. It might be, but he's not totally convinced. I emailed Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd at Emory, who forcefully responded that he thought that was not true. He thought, I mean, Rav Shechter's hesitation was misplaced and said, no, obviously, since you can give up your citizenship, if you don't, then you've bought into the system. Now, this would complicate the question if you couldn't give up your citizenship, right? If you couldn't give up your citizenship, an argument could be made that you didn't agree. But if you can give up your citizenship, he felt very strongly that if you don't, that proves that you bought into the system, and therefore you are obligated. Now I'll just add, and then I'll take the question in a second.
The problem with Rabbi is, of course, that for every individual, the cost of having that citizenship is different, naturally.
Correct.
For a wealthy person, it comes at a much higher cost.
Correct.
With much less benefit.
Correct. And therefore, so, okay, I'll say this already now, and then I'll take the question. There's something that I put at the end. From my perspective, right, what I think is abundantly clear is, let's say you're somebody who 90% of the time gets money back from the United States. So you're happy to file taxes every year because you make your $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year from the United States government. And the 1 year, you know, you get a bonus and you would owe them money, you don't want to file taxes. I think everyone would have to agree that at that point you are morally bound, because it's not just you, in theory, right, have a passport. You take advantage every year. You get that check. Right, in June or whatever it is, when it comes with a few thousand dollars, 1 year you owe them money, you don't want to pay, right? Obviously, you're shirking your responsibility to the agreement. Yes.
What if it complicates it that you can't give up your citizenship unless you're current with your tax filings? Meaning that you would have to incur the cost to become up to date with your tax filings, 3 years of return, 6 years of effort, and then...
Right, so this is why, when I sort of ran this by a few people, right, Broyd felt very strongly and said, well, you can give up your citizenship. If you don't, that means you've bought into the system. Schechter wasn't sure, and another rabbi, I'm not going to say his name because he chose to private message me and not post this, which means I think he doesn't want people to know what he's saying. He said he's actually not sure, because he said, why does the theoretical fact that I can give up my citizenship prove that if I didn't, that I, right, why does that prove I want to be part of the system? What if it's very hard? Right, and that's what he said. He said sometimes the reason people don't give up their citizenship, it's not as easy as going to the consulate and saying I'm giving up my citizenship, because you have to bet, right? Forget someone who's born in the United States, right? Let's say someone who wasn't born in the United States and he finds out at age 40 that he was supposed to be filing taxes his whole life. He doesn't even know English, right? He grew up in Israel, right? Only speaks Hebrew, right? And then he finds out that, you know, the U.S. government considers him a citizen. He owes 4 years of back tax filing and FBARs. He doesn't even know how to go about this, so he just says it's not worth it. And so, does that prove that he bought into the American system? No, right? Sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't. And that's why I think this area is a bit grayer, where Rav Shechter wasn't sure. One rabbi I spoke to was pretty sure it doesn't prove anything, and Rav Broyd was absolutely sure it proves that you did buy into the system.
But that's what I'm saying. Would it change Rabbi Broyd's opinion if he's assuming that it's easy to give up your...
So he wasn't, actually. He just said, since you can. I can check with him. I told him that after this I'd send him the lecture, and we could continue the dialogue. I can ask him, and I can follow up with you, ask him a specific opinion. But he was pretty comfortable saying that if you can give up your citizenship and you don't, that proves you've bought into the system. Rav Shechter wasn't sure, right? Fifth possibility is Rav Shaul Yisraeli, in number 16, argues that Dina d'Malchuta directly applies even for international law. And his argument is as follows. Like the Maariv Chayos, like Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, he says, the reason that Dina d'Malchuta is binding, the law is binding, is because you agreed to it. Well, if countries agree, so then, right, this is, right, well, let's right, just play this out. If the whole reason law is binding in the first place is because you agree to it, and you've now agreed to be part of the American system, and America agreed with Canada that they are going to enforce American law, so then you've just bought in, not even to American law, right? If Canada agreed to extradite people, right, in theory even, to respect American tax law such that they will enforce tax evasion in Canada, by living in Canada, you've just bought into American tax law. Because Canada has bought in to American tax requirements and will extradite if you don't follow it. So if you want to live in Canada, then you're obligated not because of your requirements to the U.S. government, but because of your requirements to the Canadian government. Right? And I gave you here, I don't want to read it inside, but basically, halacha recognizes the validity of treaties. The earliest example that's quoted is in Joshua chapter 9, where the Jews make a covenant with the Givonim, who are a tribe who from the seven nations who shouldn't be allowed to make peace with the Jews. They pretend that they are not of the seven nations. They end up making peace with the Jews. And when they find out that the Givonim were really lying to them and were really local people who shouldn't be allowed to make peace with the Jews, the Jewish people wanted to renege on the covenant, and the leader said, you can't do that. We've made a covenant, and that's all we can do. We can't back out on our covenants. And the reason's because, covenants, especially if they're made in the name of God, which it was in that case, it shows that we don't take God seriously. But more importantly, the commentaries basically say that, there's something wrong with being a treaty breaker. Right? If you agree to something, you agree to something, and that's it. Right? And Jewish law recognizes that. So one could make the argument that if Canada has an extradition treaty with the United States, that means that Canada respects American tax law, and therefore if you're living in Canada, and Canada cares about American tax law, so who cares whether America has power over you or not? Canada wants you to keep American tax law. So if we take these theories now, right, now we go through them. From a halachic perspective, does the United States have the ability, the right, to demand its expatriates pay taxes? So, if you think that the reason that we respect secular law is because the divine right of kings or governments, so the answer is maybe. Right? Maybe. If you think it's about ownership of land, right, the king has the right to kick you off the land, the government can kick you out of the land, as long as you live here you have to follow their rules. So I would say, probably not directly, but maybe indirectly through treaties. Right? Because if Canada has an extradition treaty with the United States, so maybe Canada will say, literally, I will kick you off the land if you don't listen to the United States, meaning I will extradite you. Right? That is what an extradition treaty is, literally. So number two, maybe. If it's about recognizing the law because God said there should be law, so if government set up laws, you have to respect them, the answer is again, maybe, but a good chance, yes, especially if the world has come to the conclusion that international treaties are a good thing. On the other hand, maybe in the case of expatriate taxation, since all other countries think this is unfair, maybe not. If you think, going back, I should mention the first one, that the reason we respect secular law is because the government has control over you and therefore you have to listen to them, well, because of FACTA, the American government actually controls your bank accounts, even in Canada to a large extent. That shows they have de facto power over you. So the answer is, again, probably, yes, you have to listen to the American law. If it's about social contract, as we discussed, there's a range. Ray Broyd thinks, well, if you don't give up your citizenship, you've bought in to the system. The anonymous rabbi who emailed me said he's not sure, especially when it's hard to give up citizenship. And Rav Shechter wasn't sure, and it might depend on how hard it is for you to give up citizenship. And then the fifth is if you think that secular law is recognized in halacha because of agreement, but you can also extend that through treaties, through international treaties, so then since Canada has an extradition treaty in place with the United States that will in fact enforce tax evasion, even tax evasion in the United States, again, you would be obligated. So on balance, the answer is probably yes. Right? Halacha would say that a U.S. citizen living outside of the United States, definitely if he doesn't renounce his citizenship, has the and lives in a country with an extradition treaty with the United States that will enforce tax law, and lives in a country where the banks comply with FACTA, and therefore the banks will at some level force you to report to the United States by, you know, giving the United States the means by which they could then theoretically prosecute you if you don't follow the law. For all those reasons, I think the answer is yes. You, a U.S. citizen, has an obligation to file and pay his taxes or her taxes to the United States. Now, as an accountant, right? So when I discussed this with as I mentioned, with Steve, he'd said, well, do I, as an accountant, have a responsibility, right? If my responsibility is to Canada, do I have a responsibility to the United States to respect their laws? And here, I think the answer is, well, if, as an accountant, you have two responsibilities. One is to the government, and one is to your client. If, let's take your client first. If, realistically, your client could have his assets frozen, right, be extradited from the United States, be arrested upon arrival in the United States, you, I think, have a moral requirement to your client to tell him, this is a bad idea, it's worth your few hundred dollars to file the taxes, because you are subject to criminal and legal penalties if you don't do it. What about to the government? Well, you don't have a direct requirement to the Canadian government to make the person pay U.S. taxes, but as we saw in United States of America versus Smith, the Canadian government understands this law to be fair such that it will enforce it in its borders, even though it's a foreign tax. So my feeling is probably, yeah, you do have a requirement, right, to, now, it's very tricky, because I looked in the Code of Ethics for accountants. It's tricky. You have a moral responsibility to moral requirement to the Canadian law, to provincial law, and to the law of all foreign countries if you are functioning in that country. And then when there's a contradiction in laws, you have to follow the stricter of the two. Now, I'm not sure that directly includes expatriate taxation because you're not functioning in the United States. If you were dealing with a corporate client who functions in the United States, then you have a legal requirement in Canada for sure to make sure they pay corporate taxes to the United States because they're functioning in the United States. But if you're dealing with a private client who only lives in Canada and doesn't function in the United States, I'm not sure it's technically required under that provision as I understood it, but I think generally you would be required because of the mutual agreements cross-border between the United States and Canada. Yeah?
One of the issues that everybody should be aware of is the accountant could be liable in the States. If they charge the American client, they will charge the accountant that advised them as well. So, if you're talking about
now,
the person's responsibility, if he's got a chance of being charged as well, he's got a bigger obligation to worry about.
That's probably true. And that, you know, When I looked for the laws, again, I talked to a tax lawyer. This is the case he told me that sort of set the precedent. It's only 2017. It's very new that Canada actually is enforcing extradition treaties for tax law. So, you know, it's a bit new to tell whether they would ever prosecute the accountant. I can't tell you. I don't know, right? You know, don't be the one to test it. Just,
I mean, your client has a choice to make.
Correct. The answer, I don't. But I don't know the answer. Correct. I can't speak with authority. I don't know. This I know because of the 2017 case. They will enforce extradition of a client who is evading taxes for the accountant. Again, I think on balance, you probably do have a moral legal responsibility to ensure that he pays the taxes, but not totally clear to me. Now, just my concluding thoughts here. Okay, and this comes back to our opening questions. So, as I've mentioned, right, the American citizen living in Toronto who doesn't want to file. So, while you're not stealing from the U.S. government, I think you still have a responsibility to encourage your client to file. That's what the government, both governments, want you to do. Even the child, even though you might say it's unfair, the child who's born with U.S. citizenship never lived a day in his life in the U.S., still, the fact that Canada respects that as a law that is, you know, legitimate enough, they will enforce it. I think as a Canadian accountant, you have a responsibility to encourage your client to file. Definitely, if they're going to owe money, right? We know when they owe money, or if they don't owe money and it's just a failure of filing, they probably won't arrest your client. They might, though, freeze their assets, right? That does happen, but they probably won't arrest them. They might. But if they owe money, they will, right? They straight out will. They are going to be subject to legal penalties. So I think it's pretty clear you have to encourage them to file. The one that I think is the most obvious, as I mentioned before, is if your client, right, every year gets a tax refund from the United States government for their kids and one year doesn't want to file because they're going to owe money, I think we all understand that at all halachic, legal, and moral levels, right, that person has bought hook, line, and sinker into the American system, right? They take $2,000-$3,000 a year from the U.S. government, and one year they make too much money. They don't want to pay back $3,000, $10,000 to the U.S. government. That person owes it morally to the United States. They've still bought into the system. I think there's no two ways about it. Also, this is all in terms of whether you have to file. Once you're filing, everyone, I think, will agree, you can't file falsely, right? You can't hide. Someone can't come in and say, I make $120,000 a year, I'm going to pretend I make $103,000 a year and get back $3,000 from my kids because I'll owe nothing to the government, but they'll owe me $3,000. That's not a problem of Dina Dalhuta, that's a problem of theft, right? Period, end of story, right? That's straight theft. False, right? Lying on your returns to get back a refund is theft. This is a different problem. We can all get behind that. If your client routinely takes advantage of their citizenship, right? They work, I mean, in a good way, right? They work in the States. They travel constantly. Again, I think at a moral level, that proves they don't even want to renege on their citizenship. They don't want to give it up. So again, that moral requirement comes in. The last thing I will note is that even if all of this were false, which I don't think it's not, it is, right? Even if our conclusion was that you don't have a technical obligation to pay your taxes, as someone wrote to me in response to this question, if someone would construct an argument that would say, well, Jewish law doesn't think you have to pay expatriate taxations, and then suddenly all halachic, right, all people who keep Jewish law would stop, it would be a known thing. They all evade their U.S. taxes, right? That would be what we call a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name, right? So he said, for that reason, right, even if on a technical level one could construct an argument that it wasn't true, the fact that most people pay their expatriate taxation, if you can come up with some legal loophole that proves to you that you aren't obligated, and therefore other Orthodox Jews are not, other people who claim to be keeping God's law refuse to pay their taxes to the government while everyone else does, that, he said, is clearly a terrible thing, and therefore at a moral level, you would still be obligated. So like I said, on balance, I think legally, halachically, and morally, it is pretty clear that even for your client who's an expatriate of the United States, you should be pushing them to file the taxes, file them honestly, which is what's required both by U.S. and Canadian, and I think halachic law as well.